From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyne. Today on the show, we'll consider whether and how the legacy of Martin Luther King is living on in Milwaukee. Later, it's tough to be a weekly newspaper, which drives the Milwaukee Business Journal to change how it covers business.
Our paper goes to press on Wednesday nights. Fortunately, over the years, we've had a lot of great stories, and we've had a hope from that time that it was in our paper on Wednesday to the time it hit the streets it would hold.
A mother hopes to dispel stigmas by talking about her son's depression and suicide.
If you don't talk about it, you don't have a support system. So if he had mentioned it, he would have had five friends or more that would have all been there. That's what's so sad about these people that suffer from depression. They can't open up, therefore nobody knows, and they don't have a support.
And a Wisconsin book trilogy gets a fourth chapter. Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. The nation honors the civil rights leader, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., with a holiday today. It's a day in which people reflect on how the world is different than it was a half century ago, and how some things have not changed. Of course, Dr. King was not only a civil rights leader, but he was a religious leader as well. And the intersection of the faith community with the city's racial dynamic is a subject to which Carl Carby has paid some attention recently. Carby helped organize the 23rd annual Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. prayer service, co-sponsored by the Catholic Archdiocese of Milwaukee, over the weekend. And he joins us in the studio today to talk about where Dr. King's work stands in this area these days. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
What do you see as the single most important reason to mark Martin Luther King Jr. Day, not just as a nation, but specifically here in Milwaukee? Why is it important that we do this?
His main legacy was his dream, and it's something that not only for the city, the state, and the country, it's something that we still need to adhere to, still realize that there are dreams out there that, you know, can be accomplished. And that goes along with, you know, collaboration of our community, our, you know, business, private and public sectors.
Is there something to the idea of keeping this as sort of a living holiday, if you will, you know, a holiday in which action still takes place as opposed to, you know, what we think of as a more historical kind of holiday like President's Day?
I think so, because at times, and I don't want to hammer away at our younger generation, but at times we tend to forget what our ancestors, our forefathers struggled for. You know, what we have in today's society tends to come too easy. So when we see the easy things in place, we tend to forget who laid the groundwork for, you know, the things in place right now.
Well, and you say the easy things. When you think about Dr. King's priorities, the areas of civil rights where he wanted to affect change, and you look at the state of things in Milwaukee today, do you think there are a lot of victories out there? And maybe what do you think of as successes that exist today? And what 50 years, almost 50 years after his death, still hasn't changed?
There's pluses and minuses here in the city of Milwaukee, and I would say throughout the state. There are pockets where you'll see some positive, you know, signs, and then there's, you know, you're going to see some negative. You know, of course, you know, Wisconsin or Milwaukee's labeled as one of the most segregated cities in the United States. And, of course, you know, Dr. King, his dream that everyone being treated equally, having the opportunity to live and anywhere, you know, in the city, you know, in the suburbs, wherever. And, you know, at times, you know, when we look at the statistics, it doesn't balance out. So I think those are some of the things that need work.
What do you think is most standing in the way of the kind of Milwaukee that and the kind of country maybe that that Martin Luther King envisioned?
Our city, we've got so many different cultures. We tend to, instead of reaching out and, you know, connecting with our different cultures, we tend to just want to stay within our own. And I think that's some of our minor problems right there. There, you know, I see a number of cultural groups trying to knock those bridges down. And I think there's opportunities out there.
It's always dangerous trying to put words into the mouth of a historical figure. But you know, if Dr. King were here in Milwaukee today, do you think – would he be frustrated by the pace of change?
That's a difficult one to answer. It could be a yes and it could be a no, depending on some of the things he strived for, you know, as far as equal rights, the opportunity to vote.
Certainly, there are fewer laws and you know there are fewer official things standing in the way of equal rights.
Right. There's been a number of changes, but just to get that label off of the city of Milwaukee, he himself would probably, you know, want some stronger involvement of, you know, critical people that can make change.
Well, right. So let's talk about that. And without necessarily saying this is exactly what Dr. King would recommend, how do you think, taking a page from his legacy, leaders here ought to work to make change?
Because the city has faith plays a lot in the struggles and what needs to help to make change. You've got all types of faiths, and our leaders, as far as our church leaders, they play a large figure as far as who can be very influential as far as reaching the peoples of power, the peoples that can make the change. We're also looking at the private and public sectors. You're looking at our major companies out there that can reach out and, you know, when the unemployment levels are pretty high, if there's opportunities to have programs where they can, you know, have something for our youth to train and prepare themselves for, you know, future jobs. These are some of our major players.
As you think of your own life as an African American in Milwaukee, what do you think Martin Luther King is most responsible for in affecting who you are and what you're able to do?
I would say he played a very important part as far as the choices you can make. Just because you're African American doesn't mean you have to, you know, belong to one particular type of faith. You have the opportunity to go wherever you want, worship whoever you want. And I think that plays a big figure right there. You know, when we talk about the Catholic Church, it's a big surprise that a number of people don't know how large of an influx of African Americans that are Catholic. And when we talk about the Catholic Church, everyone that has either gone to church as a guest tend to think that the church is one way. But there are surprises that there's a mixture of music, where it's you've got gospel, you've got folk music, Spanish, you've got chanting. So there's all types, and I think that's one of the main things that Dr. King spoke about in his many speeches, just the opportunity to be treated equally and having that opportunity to have that choice without being questioned.
Well, thank you so much, and best of luck.
All right. Thank you very much.
Carl Carby was one of the organizers of the 23rd annual Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Prayer Service, co-sponsored by the Catholic Archdiocese of Milwaukee over the weekend. His full-time work is with Time Warner Cable in Milwaukee. Today is, of course, the national holiday honoring the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. After her son commits suicide, a Milwaukee mother hopes to raise awareness about depression. That story when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. Depression affects nearly 1 in 10 Americans at some point in their lifetimes. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports 5% of people suffer from major depression. But despite its prevalence, many experts say stigmas around depression continue. And that's one of the reasons half of those affected by depression never seek help. That was true for Charles Kubley. The Milwaukee man suffered from depression for years in silence. He committed suicide at 28. Since his death, his mother, Billy, has worked to bring awareness to depression through a foundation in Charlie's name. Kubley joined Stephanie Lecce in the studio in October, along with Dr. John Lehrman, professor of psychiatry and behavioral medicine. Lehrman talked about why awareness is still such a critical issue in depression today.
I think one of the key reasons is due to the stigma about mental illness. I think we're in a better place now than we've ever been before, but we still have a long ways to go.
Now, Billy, your family has had a firsthand experience with depression. Tell us about your son, Charles, and what he went through.
Well, Charlie was probably the last person you would think of that would have had depression. He was a very good student, many friends, and a great sense of humor, lots of fun. And it didn't come to being until he was 23. And he had graduated from college, living with us, and I saw a jar of St. John's wort in the kitchen. And it had just come out in the news that that could be good for depression. And I was shocked. Last person anybody would have expected, and he had covered for years. And he did say to me the year before he died, I wish I had done something in high school. And so then, of course, I said, well, we need to get help right away. So we immediately started him. So he was under psychiatric care for 5 years. The psychologist, he told me that the first question he asks when he has a new patient is, are you suicidal? And Charlie said, I think about it all the time, but I'm not going to do it because of my family. And then 6 weeks later, he died. So somewhere along the line, he gave up hope.
Dr. Lehrman, is this something that you hear a lot, that people who are suffering from depression can cover for it, that even their family members don't often know they're suffering?
Yes, we do hear that. It is something that people can try to hide, again, oftentimes because they're embarrassed about it. They know something is wrong. They are afraid to share it with people, afraid of what people are going to think of them. Oftentimes another part of it is that they tend to isolate when they're depressed, which puts distance between them and their loved ones. So again, it's harder to know what's going on with that person when they're isolating more. I think oftentimes what may have exposed this to Charlie's family was the fact that he was living at home during this time, and they were really close in close proximity, and a loving mom would realize that.
I want to add to what Dr. Lehrman said. I think the stigma is also very great. And so he didn't want to share this with his friends. He was embarrassed, he said.
It seems like this effort to get rid of the stigma around depression has been around for as long as you can remember. Why is it just so persistent and so strong and difficult to get people who are suffering to understand it's not something to be ashamed of?
Well, we tried to tell our son that it's a disease. You could have heart disease, liver disease, diabetes. It's the same thing, but it's just in your head. And ours is genetic. And that's what needs to happen, that people accept it as this disease. And, of course, it is not a weakness. It's not an embarrassment. It's not their fault. Just like any other disease, it's not our fault. What boggles my mind over the stigma is that you accept physical diseases. The head isn't floating up above here someplace. We're all attached. And so I just don't understand why we have the stigma for depression. But it goes back. Wait, remember breast cancer or any type of cancer in the 40s and the 50s and it would be whispered about? That's where we are still.
I think Billy makes a good point. I think we're a product of our past. 60, 70 years ago, we had no effective treatments for depression and really didn't recognize it as the brain disease that it is today, that we understand it as today. And because we didn't, how did people deal with mental illness in 60, 70 years ago? We hid them upstairs. We sent them away to a place where they would live away from society. And I think that still is haunting us. I also think part of the nature of mental illness, a disease of the brain, is that it's so close to home. To even try to imagine this happening to us if we've never suffered from depression or mental illness, it's unfathomable. And it almost hurts too much to even think about it. I can't imagine that going on with my brain. And so it's easier to keep at a distance, and it's safer. So I think out of our own defense, we don't want to think about what having depression is. And then when you really struggle with it personally and have to face having this disease, the only thing that you have to equate it to is sadness. And we all have struggled with sadness. And we should be able to we're taught as children – well, you know, cheer up, you know, get in a better mood. But when you have the illness of major depression, it's not something you can turn around. You don't have control of it because it's a disease of your brain. It's not sadness. But that's the only thing we can really equate it to, because that's the common experience that we all have. And what we're taught with sadness is that you can just snap out of it. But major depression is not something you can snap out of.
When Charlie came clean and told you about what he was going through, what did he describe he was feeling? What was he facing every day?
Well, I think there's pain with depression that they can't really describe. But it's also takes a physical toll on you too. And after he started taking his medicine, he was living with friends in the downtown area. So I didn't see him every day. And he was participating. He was very functioning. He had a great job. I wish you could see the scrapbook of all the laughter and the fun they had with him in the office. So he was very functioning. As I said, he had everything going for him. And people need to see that a person can be functioning, not the old idea of once in the over the cuckoo's nest and things like that. But the last year he came back because his roommate had gotten married. But I knew in the morning if he was good or bad because I could tell how he was dressed. If he had his shirt tail hanging out and his tie untied, he'd go to work. But oftentimes he couldn't maybe spend the whole day. But he had told only his boss that he had this. No one in the office knew. And his boss was very understanding and said, don't worry about it. When you can come, you can come. And so that's how we lived for 5 years. And I thought he was getting better, but didn't happen.
You talked about how we lacked effective treatment for depression for so long. Have we gotten much better, though?
We have become very effective at treating depression. It's not something that we can cure, okay? It's not a one-time treatment and you'll never have it again. But we are very effective at treating depression. But it does take a while. We need to be patient. It's not something that you give somebody a medication and the next day they're better. Our medications take 2 to 8 weeks to have their full effect. And that's assuming you've gotten to the correct dose. And that's each medication has about a 60% chance, 60 to 70% chance of being effective for the individual you're treating. That means there's a 30 to 40% chance that it won't be effective for the individual you're treating. And if they're one of the 30 to 40%, you're waiting 8 weeks to see if this medication's working before you start something else that's going to take 6 to 8 weeks. So it's an illness that takes time and we need to be patient with. Major depression is best treated with a combination of psychotherapy, talk therapy, mm-hmm. and medication. The combination is better than each of the individual forms of therapy by themselves. Now, mild depression may be treated with just one or the other. But if it's a severe depression, it really should receive both modes of treatment. I also want to say that major depression causes more suffering in this world than cancer. They've done some studies to evaluate the amount of suffering that an illness causes and also the amount of cost to our society, the time off of work or people losing jobs because of illnesses. Major depression is a major cost to our society. I will also say that a treatment of the past that is extremely effective for depression, electroconvulsive therapy, is the most effective treatment. But because of the stigma, many people will not consider it. But it has about a 70 to 90% chance of efficacy in treating depression. Now, it is more invasive, so we tend to use it for the more severe cases or the treatment-resistant cases. There are new treatments that involve neuromodulation, including transcranial magnetic stimulation, and deep brain stimulation that are being studied that are also being shown to have effectiveness in treating depression.
I wonder if that's the challenge in part in raising awareness about depression, is that often those who are suffering from it may not be in a state to hear that you can get help, that there are effective treatments out there.
I would agree with that. If you're isolating and you have no energy, you don't enjoy things, you're not going to be social and going to want to share what's going on with you. Sometimes we're seeing some people that come forward afterwards, and I think that's one of the things that's making a difference with the stigma, is that we're seeing people who are famous come forward and talk about their experiences with mental illness, and people can see that this is truly a disease and can affect all of us, and that helps.
I did tell him that if he called 10 of his friends together, half of them would have said that they had had a bout with depression. The evening he died, about 20 kids came over, and one by one they sought our family members to tell them that they had had depression, and even some had been in an institution for it. If you don't talk about it, you don't have a support system. So if he had mentioned it, he would have had five friends or more that would have all been there together, just like you have with breast cancer, with any disease. That's what's so sad about these people that suffer from depression. They can't open up, therefore nobody knows, and they don't have a support.
Is that why you're telling Charlie's story today?
Yes. I've got to get it out there. I don't want a family to go through this again. And I do think Charlie felt, well, everybody will be better off without me. His friends were devastated, and they were angry because he had not told them. I see these young people that it just breaks my heart. We've had quite a few suicides this last summer on the east side, Whitefish Bay and Shorewood and River Hills and Nicolet High School. And I just wish we could reach these kids. And most of them, nobody knew about them. That's what's the whole sad thing about it, even their parents.
Why is it so important to have that sharing of the personal experience?
We need to have people get out there that have had it and see that you can be normal. What is normal? I'm normal. I have depression, but I'm still normal. And I can lead a fine life and function and so forth. So we need to see more of that.
Dr. John Lerman and Billy Kubley, thank you both so much for coming in. And Billy especially, thank you for telling us Charlie's story.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I like telling this story, if it will help.
Billy Kubley is founder of the Charles E. Kubley Foundation, created in honor of her son, who suffered from depression and committed suicide. Dr. John Lerman is the Kubley Chair in Psychiatry and Behavioral Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. They spoke with Stephanie Lecce. When U.S. Senator Ron Johnson announced he was suing the U.S. government over the Affordable Care Act, a lot was made over the difference of opinion within Republican circles over the suit. But Lake Effect essayist Avi Lank believes more attention ought to be paid to the issue at the heart of the lawsuit.
I don't often agree with Senator Rod Johnson, but I do approve of a statement he made in a recent op-ed in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. In regard to the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, Johnson wrote that members of Congress and their staff should, quote, share the negative experiences of their constituents, close quote, when it comes to health insurance. As the old saying goes, even a blind squirrel finds a nut occasionally, and with this observation, our sightless senior senator has dug up a good one. He and I disagree on what tree that nut should grow into, but more of that later. First, some background. Johnson made the observation because a provision of the law says that members of Congress and their aides have to purchase health insurance through the exchanges Obamacare requires. That was done to give the public confidence in the exchanges. Nothing, except maybe the legalized bribery of campaign contributions, moves members of Congress more than personal experience, as we learned when Ohio Republican Senator Rob Portman decided to support gay marriage after finding out his son is homosexual. Johnson has asked the court to rule that the president overstepped his authority when he allowed the government to subsidize the Obamacare health insurance premiums of members of Congress and their staffs. That, Johnson claims in the suit, thwarts the will of Congress by executive action and provides a benefit private workers are not allowed. Whether Johnson will succeed in his suit, which may be making headlines as his re-election campaign is in full swing, even he admits is unsure. But we can see one tree Johnson wants to grow from the nut he cultivated when he filed the suit, a discrediting of Obamacare. That would move Johnson nearer to his goal of repeal of Obamacare. Then, Congress could go back to subsidizing his health insurance and that of his aides however it pleased. But following Johnson's dicta that members of Congress should share the negative experiences of their constituents, I see the best result of his suit differently. If the negative experiences of Medicaid are good enough for the poorest among their constituents, then Medicaid coverage should be good enough for members of Congress and their aides as well. I wonder, what would happen to federal laws on health insurance were that to happen?
Lake Effect essayist Avram Lank was an award-winning reporter and columnist at the Milwaukee Sentinel and Journal Sentinel for more than three decades. He lives in Whitefish Bay, and his freelance work has appeared in a variety of publications. The Milwaukee Business Journal undertakes a redesign, some of it subtle, some less so. We'll hear more about it when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Teich. For more than 30 years, the weekly newspaper, the Business Journal of Milwaukee, has specialized in business and economic news around southeastern Wisconsin. But over those three decades, the reality of reporting that news has changed. Now a newspaper that waits a week to break stories is scooped by any number of other outlets, in print, on the air, online. The Business Journal has had a web presence for a long time, but a redesign that launched with the current week's newspaper is aimed at furthering the newspaper's ability to cover breaking news while still publishing a relevant print edition every week. The paper's name has changed subtly as well. More on that in a few minutes. But first, we're joined by editor Mark Cass and Stacey Vogel Davis, recently named associate editor of the Business Journal. Welcome to you both.
Always good to be here, Mitch.
Thanks.
What do you see as the most significant aspect to the changes that you're launching today?
I think probably the most significant are really how we operate. And that's, we are now a 24/7 news operation. As everyone knows, kind of things happen now, happen quickly, and it gets out there. You know, we really have switched over the past year to become that. We are a web-first operation, web meaning on the, you know, all news that happens ends up on our website first. But it's also, I think, a matter of how people consume news. Right now, it happens so fast. You're on your phone. You see it. You have to react to it. So I mean, a lot of things that are being launched are really aimed at getting news out a lot quicker.
You're now a 24/7 news operation. But as you say, this has been going on for some time. Was there something about the format of the print and the online and mobile editions of the Business Journal as they existed that just wasn't making it easy to be a 24/7 news operation that necessitated a revamp, if you will?
Yeah, really it did. Because if you think back 3, 4, 5 years ago, I mean, our paper goes to press on Wednesday night. Fortunately, over the years, we've had a lot of great stories, and we've had a hope from that time that it was in our paper on Wednesday to the time it hit the streets, it would hold. And often it did, but there were other times it didn't. So really, I think the thinking is, and this is happening at all of our papers throughout the country, is we need to react for now and for 5 years from now. And if you think about how people consume news, it's quick. It happens now. I want to know now. But then I also want to know some more later. So really our print edition has become why. Kind of tell me why. Tell me how it impacts me. Tell me how I can use this also.
Well, and so paint a picture of how is the print edition looking different now than it had in the past? Are you just not reporting any breaking news in the print edition now?
Well, I would say it's rare that'll be there, but there'll still be new things in there all the time. But I think what we're doing in the Friday print edition is a lot more explanatory journalism. Huge story. I mean, I'll use an example. Actually, a few weeks ago, we had Herb Kohl announce he was looking for investors to add on the team. We actually had that story first on our site. We were on it all week, but then on Friday we did a deep look into that issue. Who are the people who could end up buying the team? Why is he doing it? How long has he owned it? How is it going to impact the community? How is it going to impact our new search or our new effort for an arena? So really telling people how and it really impacts them.
Stacey Vogel Davis, as someone who has been in the breaking news part of this business for a while now, does that mean when you go out into the field to report a story, you're thinking of it in two different ways? What's the immediate online version going to be, and what's the story I can write that will hold until Friday?
Exactly. I mean, you put the most important information, the breaking news, you want to get that online right away. But you're also, yes, thinking of, how can I expand this and provide additional information for, the Friday print users and what kind of in-depth look can we take? I reported a story this week about the Mayfair collection, possibly including a Whole Foods and some other elements. We put the information right up on the website. And then in Friday's paper, it's, more of a Q&A with the developer, why it has happened this way, why it's happening faster than they expected. And it really should give some additional insight to our readers.
As a reporter for a physical paper that only comes out once a week, were you holding your breath about, the scoop that I have, is somebody else going to get it before it makes it into press?
Yeah, there were plenty of times where, we'd go to print on Wednesday night, and then I would spend all day Thursday checking all the local websites to make sure it wasn't there with my fingers crossed. And there were a couple of times where some of it did break before the print edition came out, and then we had to decide, what do we put up now? What do we hold on to? And, now those decisions really aren't as complicated. You put the breaking news up right away as it happens.
Well, so then has this necessitated a redesign of the website and the other online editions of the Business Journal?
Our website will obviously have a new look to it in terms of our color and our branding. But even now, in terms of the scrolling through our breaking news emails that go out, our emails in terms of the morning and afternoon, which have all the headlines. I think anybody who's out there today really needs information quickly. So, they want it, and they want the headline, and they want the opportunity to actually look at it and say, okay, do I need this? And if I do, I can actually look at the headline. If I don't, I can just move on. So really our effort now is really to just say, here's the headlines, here's the news. You need it quickly.
Well, so let's talk about the financial model, because obviously daily newspapers have seen their print circulation and ad revenues decline over the last decade. If I'm not mistaken, circulation has not been a real issue for you.
It hasn't. It's been steady. I would say that over the past, I think it's 9 out of the past 10 years, we've actually had growth in our circulation. So I don't, for us, this is not a matter of oh my God, the sky is falling. It's okay. Here's what's happening in the industry. Here's how our paper and our papers throughout the country can really grow and still be a valuable information for our readers.
Are business publication readers more apt to pay for content than the population at large?
I think so. I think they are, because it helps their business. If you want to grow your business, if you want to be successful, you have to have information. I think I've seen our readership, as I said, we've not lost anything in terms of our print paper. We've seen our numbers on the web grow like crazy. We also have areas on our web that are blocked that are just for our subscribers, and we have not had any pushback on that at all. Unlike other papers.
Well, and let me ask that. I know in the past there has been this divide between there's been free content available on the Business Journal website, but a great deal of material available only to subscribers. As you shift the focus of the website to more breaking news, does the paywall dynamic shift as well?
No, it really doesn't. It'll still be there. It'll still be for our readers, because we still value our subscribers. And really, really, it's interesting. A lot of our readers of our print edition aren't on the website. Some of them on our website aren't on print. So really, we're trying to kind of cross them both. But we're going to still be very – hold on to our subscribers very closely and allow them a lot more access on our website.
Stacey Vogel Davis, is there a such thing as a deadline anymore?
That's funny, because I'll get calls from public relations specialists or people for companies, and they want to know, when's your deadline? And my deadline is now. It's as soon as you can get me the information. So in that – respect, yeah. We're constantly putting things up on the web, and a lot of times what we're doing is, we write what the information that we have, that we've sourced and that we can confirm, we'll put it up right away, even if there's somebody we haven't heard from yet. And then as we're hearing from people throughout the day and getting more angles and more information, we'll put up updates, and that way, we're as updated as possible, and the reader knows the latest information.
Can you share some more of the nuts and bolts of the redesign? What else is different about the weekly paper?
Be happy to. We actually have added a number of features. I think a couple of them that are really interesting is one is our back page. So right near the back will be something called the Last Call. And it actually will include Stacy's Table Talk column, which has been very, very popular with our readers. But also we'll add in some other things in terms of – we'll look at area restaurants in terms of the best place for a business lunch, let's say, or the best place for a breakfast or the best place to hold a meeting. Also, you know, we may look at some other things that people do have to work, their favorite wines or beer, trying to lighten it up a bit, because what we found over the years is that people want to know about things that happen in the business world, but they also want to find out about things that happen after hours. Our executive profile, which has been in our paper for actually over a year now, is very popular because of that. It has information on the last book they read, their favorite authors, their favorite things to do. So I think that's been real popular. We're also adding an item called The Pitch, in which we'll do a profile of a local startup in the area as to how they're doing, some of the things they're finding. Again, just really trying to provide additional areas of coverage. We've overhauled our editorial page. We've added some more after-hours opportunities, really just adding some new things to the paper. While at the same time, I think the one thing we've added over the past year is our reporter pages. Each of our reporters has a page or more in our paper every week that's all about things happening on each of their beats. And you know, maybe that's something more that Stacy could talk about.
Well, and let me piggyback onto that, because one of the things that I know each of the reporters does is, you know, there's you have kind of a running blog going. Is that sort of style now – I mean, are you at the point where your online style is really informing the style of the print publication?
Well, yeah, that was part of the redesign, was really getting all of our different products to flow naturally and all be part of the same, you know, brand, which is the Business Journal. So, you know, when you read our blogs and you read the web stories and you read, you know, the reporter pages in the print edition, you're as informed as you could possibly be. Or you can pick and choose, you know, what types of things. If you just want the headlines, that's, you know, what you get. And that's one of the things about the reporter pages that is interesting that people have told me, is that, you know, if they we have more than 20 web stories on our site every day. You know, you're not going to read all of them cover to cover. So when you get the reporter page, you see what the most important stories in an industry that you're interested in were for that week. And you get a little bit of extra perspective that you might not have gotten online. So it's really putting everything that happened during the week into context.
It's kind of like a weekly best of.
Right, right. And I was going to actually add the way. I think one of the neatest things that's now in the paper every week is that we'll take the most important issue of the week according to us. And you know, kind of, and we'll do a really an in-depth kind of look at that, its impact on the city, who the players are. We'll, you know, we'll have art with it. We'll have graphs, charts. It's called our Enterprise Story of the Week, and really take a look at how it impacts our community. And I think that'll be very, very important.
I feel bad that I've saved this question for last, but I don't know that we're necessarily burying the lead here. The actual name of the newspaper has changed.
It has. It's now the Milwaukee Business Journal. We've kind of been known by that anyways, but I think what we're doing here is it's more kind of an idea of here's what our paper is in the community. We're in Milwaukee, and I think it's just a great way to show people who we are. We've also kind of really tried to make it flow through all of our products that way, and really with a nice look, I encourage everyone to look at.
So a subtle change from Business Journal of Milwaukee to Milwaukee Business Journal.
It's small but important.
Well, Mark Cass, Stacy Vogel-Davis, thank you so much. Best of luck with the redesign.
Always good to be here, Mitch. Thank you.
Mark Cass is editor, and Stacy Vogel-Davis, associate editor at the Milwaukee Business Journal, which underwent a redesign with its current issue. The paper's name has also subtly shifted from the Business Journal of Milwaukee to the Milwaukee Business Journal. One last break, and then writer Catherine Gilbert Murdoch returns to the fictional Wisconsin town she created for a new novel. We'll hear more when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Teich. Catherine Murdoch's Wisconsin-based series of middle-grade novels was supposed to be done by now. The series, which started with the novel Dairy Queen, related the experiences of a high school girl named DJ Schwenk, who played high school football and basketball in the fictional town of Red Bend. But after the trilogy concluded, Murdoch couldn't let the characters disappear. So DJ Schwenk has returned in a supporting role in the latest book, Heaven is Paved with Oreos. The central character in the story is actually the would-be girlfriend of Schwenk's younger brother, Curtis. It brings readers back to central Wisconsin as Sarah Zorn works to figure out her relationship with Curtis and her relationship with her grandmother, with whom she accompanies on a pilgrimage to Rome. We spoke with Catherine Murdoch last fall when she spoke to some real-life students in Heartland. Nice to see you again.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with what just took place in this library. We're sitting here in the library of the University Lake School, and you've just had this about an hour-long experience with the students here. What do you get out of coming to a school like this and doing a program like this? This is not about selling books, right?
No, it's not about selling books. It's gratifying on a bunch of levels. One, when I was a kid, if I had had the opportunity to meet an author, I would have given my right arm. I remember, I will never forget, that the librarian from our town met Robert Cormier at a librarian book event, and I touched her like the way someone who's met Elvis has, he sat here once. George Washington slept here. So I just remember that excitement of realizing that there are authors and you could be this. So there's lighting up those kids. And then there are the kids who aren't readers, but who you can see are really getting turned on by the process. And, oh, can I read your book? Can I've never read a book by myself. I want to read. And that is where the universe comes together. When you get a kid who's been a reluctant reader and you can see that now they're going to try it and you might open up the world for them.
Is demystification the right word for both cases, the demystification of the author as a person and the demystification of books as an accessible thing?
Wow, demystification. I'm thinking more, this is really heady for me because I think about books as very mystical. So, and the more I get into the writing process, the more abstract it becomes for me. And my son had a teacher in second grade who said, I don't know how kids learn how to read. They just do. It's magical. And that's, I feel like that. I don't know how writing works. It's just magical. So maybe I'm demystifying it for others, but I certainly don't feel it's clear in my own head.
There were a group of, 80 kids in here, and maybe three of them, maybe four of them, maybe five of them asked the question in a different, each of them in a slightly different way, where do you get your ideas? What do you take from that question?
Well, I think for a lot of people, not just kids, but for adults as well, that there is a mystical belief that stories start with ideas. And I think that's true, but what a lot of people who aren't writers don't realize is that that's just one part of it, that there's a whole bunch of craft that goes into writing in addition to the art. The idea is the art. And if you work at it, the art almost becomes secondary to the craft, that everyone can come up with an idea, but you have to put in a lot of hours. Michelangelo, it took him 4 years to paint the Sistine. Not that I'm Michelangelo, that's not my point. You can have an idea, but ideas come from, and what I try to keep saying is ideas come from a lot of different places. It's not that flash of inspiration and you see the story outlined before you. You have to put in the hours.
In a way, it's a little inconvenient that the first book, that Dairy Queen, actually started with a dream.
Yes and no, because I've actually made it into a slide presentation where I photograph the dream that I had about a girl playing football is one sentence in the Dairy Queen book. And when I do slide presentations, I have a photograph of that page and that one sentence highlighted and the math, and I calculate, do the math equation on how many words are in the book. So the inspiration was like 0.01% of the book. So the idea is a very small part. 99% of it is hard work.
This is like the iconic image of the universe with the little the sign that says, you are here.
Wow, yes. I was thinking more about, there's a myth, and I was in screenwriting for a while, and that Sylvester Stallone wrote the screenplay for Rocky in 6 weeks. And if you say that to a screenwriter, they come out of their chair. And they're like, that screenplay was shopped for years. It had a whole bunch of people. It's not that you have an idea and you sit down and you write and it's done. It's a much more technical process than that. And in a way, I find that immensely reassuring because it means that you do not have to be you don't wait for the thunderbolt to hit you. Just if you work at it, you don't have to be a genius. You just have to be a hard worker.
You, in the presentation today, talked about the idea of the sequel as being the author's effort to make sure the characters that he or she created are doing all right. You kind of swore that three was it for the Dairy Queen characters, and here is number four. Were you not sure they were okay?
I swore that 3 was it for DJ, and 3 is it for DJ. And if you read the Dairy Queen trilogy, she has this amazing character arc over 3 books, and she's really launched as a, I hate to use the word adult because that has all this baggage, but she's launched as a functional human being at the end of the book. But there were other characters, particularly her little brother, who I was worried about. And the reason I volunteered to write the sequel is I was worried about DJ's little brother. And so I wrote the sequel to show how he was doing, even though he doesn't have a huge part in the book. He's a very critical part. And he doesn't have a huge part in Heaven is Paved with Oreos, but he's a critical part of the story. And I still want to keep making sure that he's okay, because I really care about that kid, and he just needs to learn how to talk.
Well, and I wonder if there's something to the idea of characters in books for especially the grades that you target as being more than just characters on a literary page to the people that consume them, that they inhabit a larger part of the world for a kid than maybe an adult reader might see.
Oh, I totally agree with that, that even the books that I read now for kids, the good books, the example that I'm bringing up that I mentioned in the session was How to Catch a Bogle. The main character of that book lives with me. She's such a compelling character, and I'm so vested in making sure that she's okay, and I can't wait for the sequel to come out to find out how she's doing. The neat thing about children's literature, of young adult and adult literature, is that no matter what else is happening in the story, you have this arc of the main character grows up. And kids and adults are looking for direction of, you know, how do I do this? How do I live? How do I function as an adult? How do I do this better? And a good story will do that in a way that is not preachy at all and is hopefully not even noticeable. But you get that message across. And I think that's why the characters stay with kids, is because, oh, if I know how Harriet the Spy would handle this situation. I know how Hermione, okay, if I can just be more like Hermione, I can dot, dot, dot.
Well, and I think one of the remarkable things that transpires in Heaven is Paved with Oreos is Sarah, your protagonist, coming to terms with the reality of her grandmother. And it seems like an underrated part of growing up is not just understanding that your parents are flawed, but the people who often really do get a free pass, the grandparents, are real people too.
The relationship that Sarah has with her grandmother is so – it is not the relationship that I had with my grandmother, but it is so meaningful, and it is that recognition that people are fallible, and you have to make your – you have to figure out how to deal with it. You can't just push it aside. Z, her name is Azalea, but everyone calls her Z, in the book, is – she was such a compelling character for me, and I really at times had to work – to silence her because she was trying to take over the story. And she actually writes one section of the book, and she writes a letter to Sarah, and it's a quarter of the book. And I checked into a hotel. I was writing, and I really needed to get this book done. And I checked into a hotel, and it was 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'm sitting at my computer, and I'm writing the letter, and I'm crying just because the letter meant so much to me. So, wow, I broke out in goosebumps just telling that story. But that she is really, really real to me. She is not based on anyone I know, except I didn't mention this to the kids. I was in Whole Foods a couple of years ago, and there was a woman in the checkout line, an older woman, and I looked at her and thought, what makes you tick? And that was where Z started, is a woman in the supermarket.
And of course, Whole Foods does not exist in small town Wisconsin.
No.
Well, and along those lines, you have kind of created this alternate rural Wisconsin. Does it at all, when you are in real life rural Wisconsin, give you pause to think of the alternate universe Wisconsin that you have created?
I'm glad that it's an alternate universe. I really went out of my way to make sure that none of the place names are real place names, which is hard in Wisconsin because there are a lot of place names, and for a long time, the town that DJ lived in was called Red Lake. I mean, there isn't a Red Lake, Wisconsin, but there's a Red Lake, Minnesota. So I wanted Wolf Lake, which would be really cool, but there's a Wolf Lake, Wisconsin that has 3 houses in it, but I'm just, oh, come on, give me Wolf Lake. And there's a Prophetstown, Illinois, but there's not a Prophetstown, Wisconsin. So I got to use Prophetstown, which is such an appropriate name for the town where Z lives. But it is sort of a mythic, it's a mythic universe, and it's intentionally mythic because I want it to be universal enough that a lot of people can identify with it. And I get a lot of communication from people who say Red Bend is just like my town, and they live in Brooklyn. And you're like, well, actually, it's probably not. But it's still, it's good enough for, it's broad enough for everyone to appreciate.
There's a Red Hook in Brooklyn, right? Is that right?
I'd forgotten about that. Yes. There, but I don't think Red Bend and Red Hook have a lot to do with each other.
It is something to be sitting in the middle of a middle school library and knowing that it's still full of books. And one of them, I'm looking over your shoulder, is actually about Henry Kissinger, which is kind of surreal, actually. But there is something, I don't know, as an outsider, that seemed encouraging about a room full of people who were really kind of hanging on every word, talking about books in this era where we often hear that, you know, books' shelf life is limited.
Story is eternal. There is always story. There will always be story. How that story is conveyed is a bit in flux right now. I am immensely prejudiced toward paper books. I'm not a big ebook person, in part because I love the experience of holding it, and I love the experience of knowing how long it is until the end, which is just not the same with an ebook. You don't know how much further you have. And it really is remarkable how much a part of my consciousness that is that you pace yourself from where you are vertically in the book. And I'm reading a book right now, and I'm like, this is really good, but I'm not sure I can do another inch and a half of pages. And if you can get kids reading, that's what it's all about.
And did you hear how interested the kids were in the cover of your of all of your books? I mean, and I don't know that you would have that kind of conversation about an ebook.
No. There.
Well, Catherine Gilbert Murdoch, thank you so much as always, and come back and see us again.
Thank you so much. This was wonderful.
Catherine Gilbert Murdoch's latest middle grade novel, set in the fictional town of Red Bend, Wisconsin, is Heaven is Paved with Oreos. It's kind of a corollary to her Dairy Queen series. We spoke with her last fall in the real-life town of Heartland, Wisconsin, where she was visiting students at the University Lake School. You can find out more about the books at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That is Monday's edition of the program. Don't forget, you can find past segments of Lake Effect, find out more about the people who bring you the show, and check our entire program guide online. It's all at wuwm.com. I'm Mitch Teich. So great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.